Did the auto industry bet wrong on small turbo engines? Did Nissan have the Delta Wing rug pulled out from under it? And are Americans really ready for another diesel car from General Motors?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 182 for February 8th, 2013. Don't knock the Chevy diesel. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Auto Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter.
John, how are you?
I'm doing good, man.
I'm doing well myself.
Good to be having the show, and good that we got this guy over here with
Gary,
us, too.
Gary Vasilash, how are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
So,
what did you like this week, Gary? Anything happen?
Well, you know, I given what Sunday was and given who you are, so I need to ask you about some of your observations about the Super Bowl advertising.
Okay.
So, I mean, your takes are on your AutoExtremes.com website, but
yes.
Tell us a little bit about what went into your thinking.
Well, one thing is I'm really against the whole idea that you maximize your Super Bowl spot by social media, you know, doing the social media bit and the run up and get people seeing it and showing it and talking about. I don't believe in that. And Olivier, I'm a genius, just asked me, Francois, proved that, and I agree with him on this one point, don't show a damn thing. And then when you do go and you have something to show, it's that much more impactful. And they proved that on
Sunday. Specifically, God Made a Farmer.
Yeah, the farmer spot was great.
I was blown away
it was
by that spot.
It was fabulous. I mean, people forget about Paul Harvey.
See, that was my problem with that is so we're of an age, right?
Oh, yeah, that was...
So a younger generation would be like, who the hell is this guy with the old-timey voice?
But to me, it doesn't matter because his cadence is so unique, the most unique. I can't believe how he read that thing. And the words were very powerful. And when you combine those with the images, they didn't even have to put Paul Harvey's name up there. If they had just run it, even without the name, it would have been just as impactful.
But you're absolutely right, Gary. I mean, they pretty much wrote off anyone under 50.
And it didn't, I mean, it didn't even sound particularly clear. I mean, it sounded as though it was coming through my transistor radio.
Well, I think that was intentional. That was intentional.
And I thought it was very clever, and I don't know how many people noticed this, but when they were showing the pieces of agricultural machinery, they were J.I. Case, which is owned by, Fiat.
Yeah, no.
You know, very deft, very deft. You didn't see any Caterpillar. You didn't see any John Deere.
What?
You saw J.I. Case.
No New Holland? Because they have that one, too.
They hired. They also hired one of the preeminent National Geographic photographers.
No, I mean, they had a couple of handful of photographers.
Yeah. No, it was great. I loved that. I like the Budweiser spot with the little pony, the little guy.
Yeah, the colt.
Now you liked the Audi spot, the prom spot, and I didn't like that.
Well, it was so much better than last year's where they did the thing, the vampire spot. But I kind of liked it.
You liked the Hyundai one where the guy was told he couldn't play football and had to go get his own
team? Yeah, he had to go get his own crew, his own team, and he rounded up.
Almost kind of an Ocean's 11 approach to getting a team together.
All these crazy talented kids. You
but,
know?
But the Audi thing struck me as being the meet the Beckers, okay? The, you know, clever Audi send-up of everyone else. Because, I mean, so when you were a kid growing up, did your dad throw you the keys to an S6 and say, go ahead, son? You know, I mean, so wait a minute. You know, it's just come on.
It is TV and it is the Super Bowl.
Right, but I mean, I'm just saying it's just like sort of ostentatious. And I mean, it was really great. The kid goes and punches the king of the prom or whatever it was and, you know, drives away with a black eye. But
I think it was more Ferris Bueller-esque than the Ferris Bueller esque commercial that Honda did last year
with Matthew Broderick.
There was more attitude in it than that one, which is cool. I mean, you know, some of the spots are bad, some of them are real bad, but some are great. So, you know, I, like I said in my site, you know, it's difficult to criticize the USO spot with Oprah, but I thought it was exploitive. You know, I figured I'd get really hammered for that, and we got a few hate mails over that, but I just...
No, I tend to agree with you on
that
one.
It was too
easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, what I loved about the God Made a Farmer one is it's so simple. I mean, they took this old recording and they dropped some pictures on it, and bam, they hit a home run.
Well, and also it trickled out later that they went to farms.com, and that's where they got the idea.
Yeah, no, I know, but I had never seen it before.
Yeah, no, it worked out great. I'm not knocking it.
Gary, changing topics, what do you think? Consumer Reports came out this week really slamming small displacement turbo engines.
Yeah,
not getting fuel.
Well, I mean, isn't this entire phenomenon of a backlash against the MPGs? I mean, that everything now, I mean, whether it's a lawsuit or whether it's, well, we'll have to go back and recalibrate, or these things aren't all about, you know, economy. They're more about other things. You're not getting the sorts of numbers that you're supposed to be getting. And so, you know, I think part of it is this really high sensitivity to the whole aspect of how the OEMs are playing the miles per gallon game. And so maybe they're going too far, but I think that you need to have someone saying, well, let's take a look at this.
Well, I think they're going too far. Yeah, sure. If you put your foot in a turbo driving around town, you're not going to get great mileage.
Right, but if you're positioning the turbo, like in the case of the EcoBoost engine, that when someone
sees
the
word, performance and economy.
Or you think, oh, it's ecological, it's EcoBoost, right? And those things, I mean, yeah. The 6 works better than an 8 would, but it isn't like you're getting the performance, the fuel efficiency performance of a 4 out of a 6.
Let's face it, the Consumer Reports editors live in some weird universe that's, you know, not traversed by other...
I don't know.
New York, isn't that where they're at, or someplace like that?
Yeah, look, I agree with them on this, because in my test drives, the small displacement turbo engines don't get good fuel economy. They just don't. They're brilliant for the EPA test, but that's not the real world. I think there's going to be a big consumer backlash against them. I'm talking significant. I'm talking 10 miles per gallon drop-offs, and that's what consumers are going to see in the real world.
See, but whenever I get a test car and I look at the Monroney and I see the EPA numbers, I basically say, let's just whack 25% off it right off the top.
I don't even look at
them. I mean, it's just like, and that's probably what I'll get.
See, I don't agree. I find if you go by the combined number, you know, unless you live at high altitude or in the mountains, or if you're a real leadfoot, the average driver is going to get what the combined number is, or they're going to get within a mile or two per gallon of it. That's my experience.
No, mine's not.
But with the new lithium-ion hybrids, they don't get it. They don't get what the label says. And the small displacement turbos. Small displacement. I'm not saying big displacement turbos. Small displacement ones. They just, I don't think it works.
But again, the question is whether someone who has a car with a small displacement turbo drives it like they want a bat out of hell, right?
No, I'll give you my example. In doing my test driving for North American Car of the Year, I was getting 33, 34 in Honda Civics with CVT, Nissan Altima with CVT. It's getting 23 in a Fusion 1.6 EcoBoost. 10 mile per gallon difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not lead footing it. I'm just trying to mimic what I think an average driver is going to drive like. And that's a huge difference. That's all. I think CR is onto something here.
Okay.
Peter, let's go on to something else that I find way more exciting, and it's what the hell is going on with Delta Wing?
Well, a Delta Wing, remember, was designed 5 years ago by Ben Balbi to be a proposal for the next IndyCar formula, which was rejected because they felt it was too radical. Then he switched gears and converted into a Le Mans prototype, and the American manufacturers were pitched to, you know, sponsor it for the engine, and they declined, and then Nissan stepped up. Actually, Nissan Europe, but it came through Nissan America. Now, basically, the program's over, and Don Panos has taken it over, and you know, he's going to do his Elon Power Products engine in it, and Ben Balbi originally showed one with an enclosed, you know, coupe bodywork, and he's just gone off on his own. It's not going to have a manufacturer affiliation, and he's thinking of running three races this year.
And what happened with Nissan? Because, you know, Nissan, as you pointed out, really got behind the project. They've been taking the car to auto shows around the world, you know, really touting their involvement.
Yeah, it was at Detroit.
It was at the Detroit show. It was
after
Le Mans.
Yeah, after Le Mans, they technically did not have a contract to continue.
Mm-hmm.
So then they agreed to one more race, Petit Le Mans, and now it's on the auto show circuit, and their affiliation with it is over with.
Hmm.
It's too bad.
Do you know where the decision came from, though?
Well, the original decision was a one-race deal with Nissan.
Right.
Okay, we'll sponsor, we'll get it developed, we'll do the run-up to Le Mans, we'll run Le Mans, and then that was it. They were going to regroup, talk about it, see. Then they sort of decided, well, we'll do one more race, Petit Le Mans, and then that was it. Their interest ended there.
Because, I mean, they certainly have an interest in racing. I mean, with the Red Bull team that
Infinity now. The Infinity Red Bull team.
Right. All right.
But I thought because Nissan was trotting this car around to different auto shows...
That they'd continue. No.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, they're not. It's basically...
But did Panos, you know, pull the rug out from under them?
You know, I don't know if he pulled the rug out from them, but, I mean, the manufacturer interest just, you know... They just decided not to go forward, and Panos is going to run it. He can certainly afford to run it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Ben, I don't think Ben Bowie's involved with it. I don't know for sure, but it doesn't sound like
See, because that's too bad. I ran into him recently at the LA show last year, and he was so excited about continuing development of the car. He said there's a lot more speed left in the car.
Oh, there's a lot more speed in that car. But, you know, I might be speaking out of turn, but I am not aware that Ben's involved with this latest iteration of it.
Huh. Unreal. I hate when that happens, you know, when you create this beautiful thing and lose control of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bad.
Well, it's interesting. I was just looking, and according to Nissan, the Delta Wing is one of the 10 most memorable moments for Nissan in 2012.
Hmm. Well, yeah.
That was
2012.
Yeah, but I'm just like, wasn't that like 5 weeks ago?
Well, I mean, boy, they got their money's worth out of it from a publicity standpoint.
Well, and that was the, you know, it was a, we can talk about it now, but it was like a $10 million bill.
To take that car to Le Mans.
The ask was $10 million. Now, any manufacturer who gets involved is going to spend at least that much in promoting it. But the whole attraction was it's going to be the most talked about car at Le Mans to this worldwide audience, and it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically got their ROI was good on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad, but I had wished that an American manufacturer had stepped up and taken it over.
Totally agreed. Chicago Auto Show was this week. There was some news. In fact, we've got Josh Tavel coming on a little bit later in the show to talk about the new Chevy Cruze. But
that probably is the news.
That is. Well, Toyota showed the new Tundra pickup.
Which I thought was very interesting. And maybe you guys have an answer for this because I was just mystified. So for the introduction of that truck. So during Bill Fay's remarks, and you know he's the guy in charge of Toyota Motor Sales now, he said, Tundra and Tacoma sold nearly a quarter million trucks in 2012, claiming 18% of the combined retail, compact, and half-ton pickup truck market, which is about the same as our retail passenger car share. All of them are built in North America. Now, here's the part I don't get. In addition, no full-size truck has more North American parts content than Tundra. Is that possible?
I don't buy that.
I find it hard to believe.
It's not like the Camry. You know, that's their argument on the Camry.
Right.
I'm not buying that at all.
It's just...
Yeah.
Is it like Ram, Hemis, maybe it come from Saltillo or something?
Oh, if you look at the mix, no, that's absolutely true.
And the F-150?
The F-150, well, I want to say...
Is the engine's made in Windsor?
That's where you might... or did he say North American or American?
Oh, he said more North American parts content.
That I find hard to believe.
I find that hard to believe.
But it is really remarkable when you look at their numbers, especially in the compact truck segment.
They're about the only one in it.
Well, I know, but I mean, it's just like...
Besides the Nissan Frontier, there's nothing else.
And that, I mean, it's fascinating to look. Okay, so Tacoma sales were 141,365 units. Chevy Colorado... 36,840 units. Canyon, 8,735 units. Ford Ranger, which I didn't think they were still...
It's out of production.
They sold 19,366 of them, which is more than the 490 Dakotas that were sold. Okay, so...
Dakota's out of production, too.
So if you look at the total domestic compact trucks, you know, add them all together, that's 65,431 compared to the Tacoma's 141,365. So then, to your point of the Frontier, so the Frontier came in at 55,435 units. And earlier this week, which I also thought was interesting, because you know if you look at how dominant, especially Ford is with the F-150 in the pickup market, and then the one that I think we tend to forget about, speaking of Nissan, is the Nissan Titan. Mm-hmm. And did you see that?
They're going to do
Pierre Long said, as a full-line manufacturer, Nissan aims to be a player in every part of the truck business. And he's the guy in charge of their product and advanced planning. Our truck teams in Michigan, Arizona, Tennessee, and Mississippi are hard at work on a next-generation full-size truck line that will expand Titan's appeal to a broader spectrum of truck buyers, including the all-important skilled trades buyers. Our new truck will be filled with Nissan innovation and expertise without compromise. Now, interestingly enough, last year they sold 21,576, which is approximately the combined number of Ford Ranger and Dakota. But
yeah, well, you know.
So what? I mean, when do you say that maybe something isn't working and you just ought to stop?
I really don't know. You forget that Titan even exists.
You do. But the Tundra is interesting only because Toyota never gives up, or rarely gives up. Rarely.
Well, you think the Tundra was designed in Calty, right?
I believe it was probably styled in California. I believe all the engineering and the production design was done in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, they said Calty did this one.
Oh, they did?
Okay. Yeah. But the one thing that I find interesting is Bill Fay claiming the retail sales, because the truck market is a fleet market. And, you know, if I'm a contractor and I go into a store and I buy two, well, that's considered a fleet sale. Hmm. And so while I buy Toyota's and others' arguments bragging about their retail sales, I don't buy it when it comes to the truck segment, because that's a fleet segment. And so for them to claim retail really shows, in a way, that they're not successful, because they cannot crack the fleet market there.
Yeah, and to the point of Nissan, when they're talking about the trades buyers, that's what the original Titan was all about.
Right.
And you know it was.
Well, look at the van that they've come out with. It's got all these the NV 600 is
they
that
just introduced
it?
A compact NV, which I suppose is to compete with the Transit Connect. That was another announcement, being Chicago being a big truck show.
Yeah, well, isn't that the one that the New York City cabs built off of?
No, it's off another.
Okay. But anyway, the point I wanted to make is the Nissan van is a very cleverly designed van. There's a lot of cool features in it. They can't give the thing away. they can't give it away. So to hear them say that they're going to work on another Titan with all these great features, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard segment to break into.
Yep, F-Series, 645,316.
I mean, But
who knew that the many people needed trucks?
I wouldn't write off Toyota, because if you look in the minivan segment, you know, they had the Previa, and I can't even remember. It took them, I want to say, six generations before they hit it right with the Sienna. And that thing does pretty well right now for them. So that's why I say, you know, we can laugh about how the Tundra is not really doing well in the market, but if this new one, which looks pretty good, I think it looks a whole lot better than what they had out there. Never underestimate Toyota, I think.
But it's interesting to me that the compact truck market seems to be so ignored by the domestics. And it's the same thing that if we go way back, you know, back when there were like Mazda B cabs and things like that, you know, when
B210.
And they were all rolling around, and here it was, it's not such a good idea. It seems to me that this would be an absolutely great time to bring back.
Well, isn't GM doing new ones?
Colorado is supposed to be.
Right. There is a new one.
They launched it in Thailand first, and then it's supposed to be coming here.
But the reason that they don't do it is because you get into the showroom and you say, oh, I'm interested in a compact truck, and the salesman puts his arm around you and says, you know what, for $10 or $20 more a month, I can put you in a real truck. And that's how it goes. And so they haven't been successful at it, although Toyota does take the Tacoma seriously, and they sell pretty good numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that's my point. I mean, it's, you know, 141,000 vehicles from them, and then an additional 55,000 from Nissan. That's not bad.
Right.
You know, you're talking over 200,000 units that these two are selling. And when you have 65,000 from the domestics in that category, it's like, aren't they abandoning something
that
they could be making money at?
They've abandoned it. And really, when you look at the Colorado and what is it, the Cheyenne? Canyon. Excuse me. They're really a little bit bigger than that. I wouldn't exactly call them compact trucks.
You know, Chevy, GM showed that Cheyenne concept pickup. Do you remember that about 5 years ago?
That's why I'm thinking of that as the name.
I thought that was really cool. And then they just, you know, here's the opportunity. Now, technically, the new GM trucks are pretty cool when you read all about them. Mm-hmm. But they showed that Cheyenne truck, and it was like, it looked really new. You know what I mean? And, you know, GM did all this stuff, and then here's your old truck, just freshened up a bit.
Right. The new one doesn't look really new.
Well, it doesn't. It's more chrome on the fascia. And
No, technically, they did a lot of cool stuff with it, but it just, design-wise, I think.
Right.
And Toyota's design looks new.
Modern. Well, it looks very fresh. I think that's what they did.
Oh, there it is up there. Ben got it on the screen. Yeah. Boy, you're fast, Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah, that looks cool.
Hey, Ben, do we have that Corvette Le Mans prototype illustration? You know, I forget the gentleman's name.
The one on your site?
There it is.
Yeah, there it is. A gentleman by the name of Nielsen Hines sent us that. He was reading about my Corvette, you know, idea to go to a separate brand within GM and then really go for it on the track. And that's his vision for a Le Mans prototype to run for the overall win. Looks great.
It does. It looks really cool.
Yeah. I actually heard from a higher up at GM and said, boy, that looks pretty good, actually. Sometimes, you know, those guys need to see something like that and to get
the juices going, get the ideas flowing.
Man, you know, it does look good. That does look like a Corvette, you know, and prototype guys. So,
what would the odds be on it becoming a separate
brand? 0-0. The odds of it becoming a separate brand, 0. Odds of them going for the overall win at Le Mans, 0. you know, they have to justify their GT program every year, which is a, you know, one of the world's best, but it's a struggle every year to get that bill signed. So, yeah. You know, for an American manufacturer to decide to run for the overall win at Le Mans against Audi coming up, Porsche,
Toyota,
it's a $500 million bill for the first 4 years. And that just gets you in the game. You know, that
puts a car on the grid.
Yeah, well, that tunes up your technical resources, that tunes up your engineers and aerodynamicists, your production or the materials people. That's what it would cost. And then once you spend that, then you'll have to see where you're at. That doesn't account the promotional budget or anything else. That's just hard R&D, $500 million bill. And you show that bill to the American manufacturer and they just go, no, not going to do it.
But, I mean, if you think about, I mean, the problems that the car companies in Europe are having right now, I mean, what's the long-term outlook for them supporting a 450 million euro.
Well, apparently Volkswagen is going to run Audi and Porsche, and they don't really care.
Yeah.
You know?
Somebody forgot to tell them there's a recession going on in Europe. Hey, let's take a quick break right now, and let's get our guest on. So, Ben, let's go for that. Josh Tavel, thanks for joining us here on After Hours.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
So tell us what you do.
Yeah, I'll just to make it go quick, he's the vehicle performance manager for small cars at Chevrolet. What I like about this guy, he's got great racing background to him, really understands all that. But the big news is you've been working on this diesel Chevy Cruze.
Yeah, I have. For the past 2.5 years, I'd say, we've been hitting this one pretty hard. And it's interesting, I saw a comment I think you made earlier about how this is a litmus test for everybody else. And I think that was perfect, right? When this project started within GM, obviously there were people that were absolute gung-ho on we got to do a diesel, and then there were ones that were like, oh, I'm not sure if I get it. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of good discussion when this thing started. And as the car has been developing and showing and we get in front of all the right people, there's just been this snowball excitement about this car within GM. And
is this an all-new engine?
This is an engine that we've actually used in Germany and several other places within Europe. In fact, we've sold 33,000 Cruzes this year with basically this engine. Hmm. We've made some modifications here for the U.S., obviously. We've sold over 500,000 diesels just this year.
So the basic engine's the engine, but the modifications are necessary for emissions?
Exactly, yep.
But you don't need urea. You don't need SCR for this, do you?
No, we do have an after-treatment system.
Oh,
you do? I think for the next several years, I think any company that's going to bring in a diesel with a significant compression ratio will have an after-treatment system.
So, well, let's go through that. The displacement is?
It's a 2-liter engine, and there was a lot of discussion about what's the right vehicle to put this thing in, because obviously a 2-liter diesel, 258 foot-pounds of torque, we can boost it to 280. I mean, this thing's an animal. You kind of are seat rides. You need to get to know the back of your seat more than you do the bottom of your seat.
What's the compression ratio that you got to run?
16.5 to 1.
16.5.
Yep. So I mean, that's what you got to do. You got to squeeze these diesel engines. You know, the number of media guys have brought up some ghosts from the past, and you know, that's one of the reasons why we've chosen this engine in particular, because this thing is it's kind of an Iron Duke engine. It is one heck of a solid engine, and we've certainly put it through the ringers, and the rest of the globe has already put it through the ringers for us too.
So how long has it been available in the rest of the world?
I'm not sure how many years, but that base architecture engine's been around, I'm not sure. I would probably say it's been out for 5 years or so.
So is that the one that they did with Fiat?
No.
One of your favorite companies?
No, this was a GM design, solely GM design engine. So
we did add
the after-treatment system.
And I thought if all the diesel experts I thought have told me that if you kept a diesel to 2 liters or less, you could get by without selective catalyst reduction.
It's really, you know, how much are you squeezing the air and the gas inside the chamber? That's really what it is, because you're making a lot of heat. You're going to make some NOx. And I know Mazda's pumping their upcoming diesel.
With low compression.
And they're a much lower compression engine, and they don't have the after-treatment system. With our after-treatment system, We can squeeze it hard. It's incredible what we do. We actually have 5 injections per stroke at times. Mm-hmm. We have our main, we have 2 pre's, and we have 2 posts as well. And we do that for noise. We do that for emissions control. We do that for after treatment temperatures as well. So what we basically do is we have outside of the turbo is right at the exhaust port, so we can spool up almost instantly. After that, we go into the close coupler, the DPF, which is basically a particulate filter that grabs any soot. So you'll never see coming out of a diesel anymore any of these black puffs. That's all way ancient history.
Plus, the fuel's a lot cleaner than it used to be.
The fuel's a lot cleaner. It's a lot more consistent. And then we go back down into basically a cat. It's a little more high-tech than the standard cats, and we inject some urea at times to control the NOx.
So is it
a 90% reduction compared to the last diesel we made. I mean, it's the cleanest diesel we've ever produced.
Mm-hmm. So it's manual gearbox only?
It's an automatic gearbox only, and there's a lot of discussion about that. A guy like yourself might say we wanted a wagon with a manual.
No, I wouldn't tell you that.
I'm the guy who would have said that.
That's John.
And believe me, I mean, everyone at GM understands that. I mean, we got a lot of really pretty strong execs right now. I mean, Mark Royce, all those guys, we understand that desire. But the diesel market, really, it's moving from that niche market, right? In 2008, I think there were 10,000 or so compact diesels sold. 2011, I think there were 60,000 sold.
Even more importantly, I was talking to Peter about this earlier. If you look at the take rate for diesels in the model lines where it's offered, it's way above the take rates for vehicles that offer a hybrid.
Absolutely. The data I've seen, I think, of one of our competitors, I think 13% were manual transmission buyers in a gas version of the car, and in a diesel version, I want to say it was about 30%.
Wow.
So it's a higher take. But you do have that niche market, and that old-school diesel market is a manual transmission buyer. But, you know, as times are progressing here, we're going to smaller displacement or turbocharged. You needed a fence, I think, to keep me from popping over here.
From jumping in on that discussion. Well, we can get into that later. Let's talk diesel for the moment.
But yeah, so, you know, as we're transitioning into this becoming a more mainstream option, the automatic transmission was the right play for us at this time. You know, we're not talking future product and what we'll do, but at this point in time, I think that was really the right choice to do.
So is this a fuel economy play or is this a performance play?
Yes. I think what this is if you look at diesel buyers, it's a diesel buyers love technology. And bar none, diesel is, it's impressive. To give you an idea, Take a guess how many calibrations we have within the diesel ECM only, the engine control module alone. Take a shot. How many calibratable values?
Well, there's no spark, so yeah. That makes it easier. So it's just air and fuel and RPM,
that's
right?
That's it, right. Yep, 33,000. And that's not including maps, tables, and everything. That's simply labels that we calibrate, 33,000 labels. It's almost twice what we typically do in a gas. The technology behind these things, the control that we have around these diesels now it's astronomical.
Why do you need so much more? Is it emissions that drive that?
Diagnostics is an important part. I'd probably say 17,000-ish is probably diagnostics. We do have to keep control of that. There's a lot of modeling within the engine. As I said, we're injecting 5 times.
Per stroke.
Per stroke. Per bang, basically, right? We got the main injection, and then we want to form that curve, whether it be we want to make it for power, we want to try and reduce any noise, we want to make sure our after treatment temperature is staying to the ideal temps. It's a lot of work. The calibrators within this program team, I can tell you more than any other program team, I know my powertrain friends better, and I know the coding within the powertrain better than any program I've ever worked on, because it is that involved.
When will it be available?
April is when we're going to start pushing them out. You know, we're
showrooms by May then or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the rating, EPA?
Right now, we haven't tested it.
Oh, okay.
We're staying competitive right now with
Wait a minute.
Jetta.
The press release said 42 miles to the gallon
42.
Highway.
That's correct.
So I'm
so that's got to be true.
Absolutely.
I'm surprised that's the Jetta's number, 42.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
By the way, I agree with your automatic transmission decision because, you know, this is a country where few people buy manuals. Maybe diesel buyers buy it more, but What's going to really make a difference is selling this to a lot of people who would have never considered a diesel.
Yeah.
And if you only had a manual, you would have limited the audience. Yeah. So I think you made the right move there.
Yeah, we're at a tipping point, I think, within the diesel market right now. And that's kind of where we're heading. And with this diesel, we can talk turbocharger, naturally aspirated, small engines all day long. But with a diesel, no one's ever going to have any comments as far as performance versus fuel economy.
Diesels love turbos, as you know. They love them. In fact, the diesel was made for a turbo, it seems.
What are you doing to address noise? A lot of people are concerned about the noise that diesels have historically made.
I'll tell you this. Typically, I drive a diesel home every night. And I purposely didn't take one because knowing you guys, I wouldn't have been able to resist putting you in that car. I can't wait for when we actually display this car. I think we've honestly game-changed what the diesel market's going to be. So what we've done, obviously there's a lot of combustion tuning, basically forming the pressure curve and how we manage that. That was a lot of upfront work, dyno work that we've done. And then obviously there are some certain frequencies that don't exist in the car. The Cruise right now, it's known to be a relatively quiet relative to its competitors. So it was a great architecture to start from. But we've actually been able to take it further than what the current Cruise is. And I think I'll phrase it to that level. There has been a few acoustic content ads where we've tried to nix out a couple of frequencies. But that typical knocking noise and that come with diesels, with the control we have about these, the 33,000 values that we've calibrated, we've been able to take most of that noise away.
And would you say those five injection pulses are the key enabler to quieting it down?
I would say that's probably one of the largest ones, yeah, I would. There's been, like I said, there were a couple frequency content that would still get through the vehicle, and we've mitigated those with very selective and strategically placed material. And as a result, I mean, the driving experience that you have in the car now, just heading down the road, it's phenomenal. It's truly amazing. It really is. I can't wait to get you guys into the car.
What does this do to the Cruise Echo?
I don't think it's going to do much. It's not going to cannibalize it.
There's a big price difference, right?
Well, let's go from there. We're coming out with basically a 2LT content in the diesel. Okay, that's about a 22,300-ish car on the gas side. So we're $25,695. So it's about a $3,300 upcharge for the diesel. Now there are some tax credits out there as well. From the government that'll help offset that.
Really? For diesels?
There are.
I didn't know this.
Yeah. I actually didn't either. My marketing people found that.
Well, you better get the word out, because if anybody should know, it's the four of us sitting here right now.
Yeah. So there actually are some out there. I was given the number, but because I personally haven't seen it, I'm not going to tell you what it is. But it was a significant number. So it's about a $3,000 walk from that standpoint. So Cruise Eco. One, the Cruise Eco manual is the 42, right? We're the class leader. It gets the number. Go to the EPA website, see what the people are submitting. The Cruise Eco manual gets the number. We're proud of that every single day, and we watch it. Honestly, I know there's a lot of talk about the labels, not to veer off too much, but at GM, we watch. We very much watch what we do, and there's a lot of things you can do within labeling a car, but there's an awful lot of times where we'll actually say to ourselves, real world isn't quite what we could label at, so we'll actually knock ourselves down a couple to make ourselves more on par. Because there's nothing worse than telling a customer you're going to get 33 combined and they're coming back at 28. Cause you'll pay for that all day long, and we don't go down that path.
Good for you guys. Yeah.
And why don't you announce that? I mean,
it's hard to explain to someone other than car guys that truly understand the industry, right?
But, well, it's a risk because, you know, so many people shop for cars online and they can put them side by side on the screen, and then they just look at price and fuel economy. And if you're not in the group, bing, you're off the comparison.
It is.
The way
but
GM
the
purchasing used to work.
The EPA is getting wise to that too, right? I mean, we've seen a number of audits recently that have resulted in some bad effects for suppliers. So, you know, they're realizing this effect, and I think they're addressing it as well. So
what's his title again?
Vehicle Performance Manager.
So you have Sonic, RS, what is it? Is that what it is?
Sparky.
So talk to us about these high-performance turbos and the Consumer Reports, or don't you want to talk about that?
No, I think it's a absolutely a legitimate question, and the buyer, when buying a car, should think about what is my driving style? Can I keep my foot off of the floor pan? If you can't and you want to get fuel economy, the turbo isn't the best option in that case. But for the person that can drive a moderate schedule or wants to drive eco-friendly, you will do better in a turbo all day long compared to a naturally aspirated engine. And the other things you kind of need to compare when you guys make that decision is what's the other technologies within the engine when we're trying to compare apples to apples. But, you know, again, when I go back, I look at J.D. Power, look at all of our metrics. When you go to the EPA website, you know, customers submit what they actually got. And I do it every month. And I take a look at what our customers telling us they're getting compared to their labels. And on the Cruise, for example, we're exceeding on every one of them.
So you're saying if you want performance and fuel economy, you get a turbo. If you want just fuel economy, you don't.
No, if you want just, if you can't keep your foot, if you want fuel economy and you can't keep your foot off the floor pan, you do pay for that a little bit in a turbo as opposed to a naturally aspirated engine. But if you can drive light and moderate, you can get the fuel economy. And then when you want the performance, stick it to the ground, pull yourself out of the hole and, you know, merge onto the traffic or whatever it is you want to do.
I've been doing a lot of test driving lately where I've decided I'm just going to keep up with traffic because now I'm driving like everybody else, right? Just normal. And what I have found is that the new hybrids with lithium ion batteries, not the nickel metal hydride, the nickel metal hydride ones nailed the label, or even beat it a bit. The lithium ion ones don't come anywhere near the label, is my experience for hybrids. And where I get the best real world fuel economy is with cars with CVTs.
CVTs, yep. Our Spark's coming out with a CVT.
Are you?
And there's good CVTs and there's bad CVTs. I mean, from an enthusiast driving perspective, well, maybe there's not a good one from an enthusiast standpoint.
I found that most CVTs are real bad as from an enthusiast perspective.
Yeah, but I'd say, you know, like if you drive the new Honda Accord, which is Honda's first ever CVT, and it's done in-house, they don't buy it. Mm. They've done a damn good job for an Accord buyer. And Nissan, I think, has done the best CVT job of all. Of course, they work with JATCO. I think they own even part of it. They've done a terrific job with it. And again, for an Altima, for the Altima driver, that's a good combination. And they get spectacular real-world fuel economy.
Yeah, there's a ton of neat engineering solutions out in the field right now. You know, which ones will stick or necessarily? I don't necessarily think one's going to stick and one isn't going to stick. I think, like you're kind of getting at, depending on the segment, on the buyer that you're attacking, you know, these options are the right thing. And honestly, some people have said to GM that, oh, we should focus on one particular solution. But in reality, we don't think that's the right solution. You know, we can do a battery electric Spark. We can do, you know, an extended range Volt. We can do a manual Eco that's going to pull it every day of the week. So we can do all those solutions to allow our buyers to do it. I think the biggest thing is educating the buyers, making sure that they understand, you know, what type of driver they are, what kind of trade-offs they want to make, what do they want, and we can cover all of those different ideas.
I don't think small turbos are going anywhere, John.
Going away, you mean?
No,
I don't think they're going away either. But
I don't know how they can with the upcoming, you know, mile per gallon type improvements that we've got to do throughout the next 10, 15 years.
Yeah, that and the weight loss program, I mean, they're going to be small.
Well, but they're going to downsize all of the engines, and they're going to need to be turbocharged. But then the question is, you know, how do you position those things? So to the point that you're talking about the Spark with the turbocharged engine, that somebody's going to get after it with that, right? Or the Sonic? I'm sorry, the Sonic. I mean,
Sonic. Yes.
So it's about driving fast.
Right. That's right.
Legally, but fast.
Yes. Look at what Ford's doing with the 2014 Fiesta. They're putting the 1 liter mm-hmm. turbo in there.
Right. Well, look, I've been a huge fan of the EcoBoost engines, you know, even this 1.6 up to now that we've had. But I'm telling you, I got a 10 mile per gallon difference in the Accord and the Altima with their CVTs. with 2.2-liter engines versus the Ford Fusion EcoBoost with the 1.6. And I'm just driving, like I'm saying, I'm just keeping up with traffic. I'm not lead-footing it at all. I'm not trying to get the performance. So a lot of buyers are going to run into this, and they're going to talk to their neighbors, and they say, what are you getting that Accord? Oh, I get 33. And they're going to be going, damn, I'm getting 23.
Yeah.
And that's when I think there's going to be a backlash against these small displacement turbos.
There's a threshold, and there's a knee in the curve that if you fall off of that curve, you're almost in the performance mode at all times. And you have to stay away. You have to be very cognizant of what that threshold is, given your vehicle mass, your aero, everything else in the car.
I know, Josh, but when there's all this traffic behind me and I'm trying to not get into the turbo, it doesn't work. I mean, people just get in the car and they drive. The average person does. Yeah, there are those who are hypermilers and, you know, they're in their Priuses going 45 miles an hour in the right-hand lane on the highway, you know, to get to that magic number. But most people don't drive like that. And I'm not convinced that these small displacement turbos, I know the industry's committed to them, but I'm telling you, my experience is real world, they don't deliver the fuel economy.
I think the definition is what is a small. You know, I worked in Brazil for 3.5 years. We have small engines there. So I think there's a threshold of where does small become small, and at some point it becomes you just have to tip in too far all the time. You're constantly into the turbo.
Anything under 2 liters is in my experience in today's technology, you're just into the turbo too much.
So what happens when John's driving and he's in the cruise diesel and he puts his foot in it and then he gets back to normal?
You know, the thing is just like
number one, the smile goes from ear to ear.
And he quickly steps out because he realizes, whoa, I'm going to get pulled over in a second. After that goes, the diesel is a very, how do I phrase it? It's a very strong, there's not a lot of variation, you know. Obviously, you mentioned my background. I like to tip my foot in and have some fun with the cars. And between me and my energy engineer, who is, you know, just perfectly always into DEFCO and just everything is just right, there's not a big spread between us. The diesel's it's quite robust in many senses of the word.
That's why I think the take rate on them where they're available in the American market is so high, because of just what you're saying there, Josh. You know, you can baby it and get super fantastic fuel economy, or you can really put your foot into it and merely get great fuel economy. Like you say, there's not that much variation. And I think that's why once people experience these things, my belief is the sales are going to surprise everybody.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's not going to change like that. But I do think we're going to, I mean, let's face it, right? 2008, 10,000. Right now, there's 60,000. That's a pretty good curve going up. So now that we're entering the market, where will it head? Let's see. We've left ourselves pretty open for production volumes to kind of feel this out. You know, and like I said, the product has really impressed a lot of people within the company, and there's a lot of excitement. This is a pretty big snowball within our company, but to try and get this car out and get it in everyone's hands, because we're confident once they're in it, once they compare it to the competition, it puts a smile on everyone's face. I'll leave it there.
Is GM doing anything to get more service stations to have diesel pumps that aren't on truck islands?
That's a tough play. When we introduce the car, we're introducing it in kind of diesel-heavy markets, right? And we know what those are from our competitors. We know what those are with our Duramax. So we know where those are. So that's actually where we're kind of focusing our initial launch and most of our product as far as production is going to be heading to. Trying to move dealers, that would be a Mark Royce question, I would say, or move gas. That's beyond my power band, I can tell you that.
So I got another question then. Would this engine fit in the Sonic?
There would have to be some modifications.
Because I got to tell you, even though I've been trashing small displacement turbos here, the most fun small car I've driven so far is a Sonic with the 1.4 turbo and a 6-speed manual. It's just an awesome, from a driving standpoint, it's an awesome combination.
It is. It's a good
car. And I just thought, man, if you could make that a turbo diesel. It'd be all the more awesome.
A 2-liter turbo diesel would be a little excessive, even, I think, for my taste in that car. Yeah, that would be a little excessive.
Certainly fit in the Malibu, right?
It would. Yep, it would fit there.
So I got to believe GM is really going to be watching. And I think the whole industry is going to be watching this car to see how well it sells.
Yeah, there's a lot of eyes on it. And, you know, I think most people within the company really get it after they've been in the car. And I mean, honestly, this was, you know, this project, Ackerson has his name all over it. Mary Barra, Mark Royce, Doug Parks, Jim Federico. I mean, right down that channel, there's been a clear vision of what this car needs to be from the beginning, which has been, it's been awesome. It's been a great project to develop this too, because we all knew where we wanted it to get to. It's been a real pleasure working on this one.
Was Cafe the reason why it was brought here?
I don't think so. I think it was, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we're trying to provide enough alternatives for the customer to be able to do, to be able to fit their driving style, their driving needs. I don't think Cafe was the big play, because let's be honest, right? I think everyone knows who's driven a diesel. They know what the label is, and they know what they really get. And if you look at Volkswagen's ads, the first thing you'll see on their website is results may vary awesomely and things like that, and they have different people that talk about what they can do in a diesel. Diesels get better fuel economy than they do on the EPA label. I mean, that's real world versus fact. So I don't think this was as much a Cafe play as opposed to trying to provide a customer an alternative that we think really does work.
No, my guess is GM does not need this diesel cruise to hit Cafe. I think it's a great and a gutsy move on the part of the company to put a diesel passenger car in the U.S. market with an American brand name on it. It's one thing for Volkswagen, BMW, Audi, Mercedes to do it. It's very different for an American car company to do it. And I think it's great. I'll bet it pays off.
Once the people get in it, there's no way it can't, in my opinion. And we got to educate them. You know, I mean, like I said, we've sold 500,000 passenger car diesels. It's not like GM is new to diesels right now. It's not like it's 1983 and this is an Olds or something where we're converting a gas engine.
You don't want people to remember those.
We know. Yeah, someone will slap me tomorrow.
Yeah, that's the reason probably why you haven't had a diesel since 1983.
Yeah, we know how to do diesels. I mean, we know how to do them in Latin America. We know how to do them in Europe. We do them, 500,000 of them, 33,000 cruises already. You know, the after-treatment system, Duramax has it. We've tweaked it even beyond what they've done to try and fit our needs. But, you know, there's nothing too new here. To our company, obviously to the U.S., it certainly will be.
Well, good. Hey, why don't we move into the rapid-fire part of the show right now where we take questions from the audience. And, Ben, let's let it rip. Okay, S10 Baja wants to know if the Colorado or Canyon will get the 2.8 diesel. Come on, GM, he says. We want a truck that doesn't pull any punches and will make a statement.
I understand your statement, but I can't talk about the future product for that one.
The mayor in Annapolis, Maryland says, I really enjoyed your auto show coverage. For the great job, I'm going to buy each of you a car. You have the choice of the 2014 Corvette Stingray or the 2014 SRT Viper, or maybe you would like to gamble and take a next-gen Shelby Mustang. You can choose coupe or convertible, even if it won't be available this year. Please choose a color combo if you like. Peter?
I'd get a Stingray, and I'd get it in that charcoal blue color that they showed at the show.
Yeah. Gary?
Agree 100%. Certainly not red.
No.
No, and I agree, too. That car was good. And I'm not even going to ask you, Josh. Yeah, I think you'd get fired if you didn't say the Stingray.
It's an easy choice.
You know, I think the Viper's cool, but, you know, I'm not a Viper guy, and all the Viper Easties will be mad, but I would have done an alloy Hemi V8 in it. and cut the weight on it even further, then I might be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Aluminum V8 Hemi.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
I mean, Ralph Shields, they've got to have some badass V8s over there that would
stick right in there.
Plus, I like the sound of it better than the V10.
Okay, Glenn Wall says, the price of fuel went down before the presidential election, and now it's going back up after the election. Please comment. Be nice, though, he says. Gary, you want to?
I think that, you know, we lose sight of the fact that petroleum is on the world market, and who our president is or who our president isn't doesn't make any difference. And the whole thing about, okay, look at the price of gas in Canada, okay? They pay more in Canada for gas than we do. And guess what? They drill lots of petroleum in Canada, right? So it's like, yeah, it's silly to draw any.
Well, they're reformulating for spring fuel.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And
then there's always a fire somewhere.
Yeah, there's that fire downriver.
You know, there's a fire in Ohio. There's fire in Illinois. Oh, no, wait a minute. This spring there's a fire in Ohio.
Of course, if you see those refinery plants, I mean, it makes like the Blade Runner look like, you know, the deck of the Starship Enterprise. I mean, it's just like, holy moly, these things are just.
You just made me think. Fire in the mountains. Run, boys, run. Hey, we got a bunch of calls here. Ben, let's bring the first one in.
Hey, guys. This is Scott V. calling from Sterling Heights. Great show, as always. I am the proud owner of a Cruise LTZ, and I think it is still the single best compact car on the market today. But what I find strange is that the Buick Verano got the 2-liter turbo performance version, and Chevy still doesn't offer a Cruise SS with the same engine. What is the reason behind this omission, especially considering the Cruise's success in racing and the cult following of the previous Cobalt SS?
Have you driven?
Strong feeling a Cruise SS could really usher in a new class of youthful performance buyers. Thanks, and please build it.
Have you guys all been in the Verano Turbo yet?
I have, yeah.
That's a fun car. Turbo manual is just a blast to drive. As far as stuffing that one into the Cruise, no, there's no plans right now to put that into there. There's always some discussions, but at this point in the program, no, I don't think that's in the cards. I'm not quite sure how that would fit in.
Is that partly to keep, you know, give Buick something unique that Chevy doesn't offer too?
No, I think it's more of just a play of, is that the right thing for the Cruise right now? And, you know, it excites me. Things like that excite me, and there's other things that we've talked about like that. But I don't think it would do anything for us at this point in time.
What has more torque, that engine or your new diesel?
I believe with the Overboost, we would beat it. On the Cruise diesel.
See, there you go. Answer.
We have another phone call.
There is then? Horsepower.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of them, but we got another. This comes from LOH Chief, who says, what about the reliability of all the pollution stuff that plagues the larger Duramax, Cummins, and Powerstroke diesels?
That plagues? Okay, I'll accept it at that point. But I think, like I said, we did do some modifications as far as how we've structured the whole after-treatment system. And I kind of referenced there about how we try and maintain temperatures and what we're doing for that. I mean, we've got exhaust temps at engine out, DPF out, SCR out. I think there's four of them that we have within there to try and maintain the proper balance of temperatures. And I can tell you, I don't know of any failure throughout the development that we've experienced on this SCR, on any of the after-treatment system. But I can also tell you the amount of scrutiny on that has been significant. There's no room for a misstep on this one.
Okay. Hey, Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Hello, great show. Just real quick, Jim Campbell calling, and not the Jim Campbell from Chevrolet Performance. did Cadillac not put together a prototype car, and did it run in Le Mans and those things, and how well did it do in those kinds of things? Thanks.
Yes, they did in 2000. GM had a big blast. Initially, they went about it all the wrong way. They had the big buildup at the beginning when the car wasn't quite ready, not anywhere near ready. And then they ran it for 3 years, and it started to actually do well, and they pulled the plug on it. And the reason I was given was that they didn't want to spend Audi money to develop direct fuel injection, which is a joke because the corporation as a whole spent a fortune developing direct fuel injection for their engines. There was just a lack of will at the top of the corporation to keep the program going. It's unfortunate.
It is.
What year did we pull the plug on that?
2003, I believe.
You know, I'm guessing Bosch probably developed the direct fuel injection for Audi, but
it cost them nothing.
Well, it's too bad. As you recall, John, there was a huge global media event in Italy a week after Le Mans. So GM basically entertained 500 journalists at the debut of the Cadillac LMP at Le Mans, which is a mistake because one of them caught fire like 4 hours in. It was just a debacle.
You don't do it that way.
No, you have to.
In motor racing, you go and prove yourself, then you brag about it.
Yeah, exactly.
AAH guest 787 says, what's been done to allow starting and running the Cruise diesel with low to sub-zero temperatures?
Yeah, we talked about compression ratio on that, and these lower compression ratio engines are tougher to start. So 16.5, that was kind of a fundamental starting point on this one. Beyond that, we can start at negative 40 degrees. I've been in Baudette, Minnesota, doing it. It's a miserable time to do it, but she fires up. It'll crank a couple more times beforehand. But with the glow plugs, we've invested. Actually, it's one of the differences we've done in bringing the engine here. There's not a higher technology or probably cost, frankly, on the glow plugs that we've put into the engine for that specific reason. So they're really efficient. They light off pretty quick, so as a result, we can get our temps and fire up quite well.
Good. Ben, let's bring in another phone.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question for your guest tonight is, was there any debate within GM whether this engine should be launched in the Buick Verano versus the Chevy Cruze? At the price point of the diesel Cruze, it's obviously, there's a lot of features, but it is a little bit higher. And whether or not maybe it would have, again, if there was any debate, that maybe it would have been better to launch it with the Verano first, and then if it took off, expand it from there. Thanks.
There was a ton of debate, quite frankly. There really was. There was a lot of debate. You guys can argue. I mean, we could all, you know, see what those arguments would be. In the end, it was decided that the Cruze was the right platform. And again, it kind of goes back to, we've sold over 500,000 Cruises. It's the number one selling Chevy we have. People love this car. It's a quiet platform to start from. There were a lot of reasons that made the Cruze the right place to start. The Verano was, you know, at the time developing. I don't think we had even announced it yet when this program had already started. And in retrospect, I think it was still the right decision for all of the reasons that we kind of went through here.
Yeah.
I think from a design point of view, if you look at the Cruze, it looks more European than the Verano does. And since there's an association of diesels and European vehicles.
Interesting, Gary. Yeah, interesting observation. Okay, let's see what's next here. Chuck Grenchy wants to know, what's involved with recharging the urea after treatment? Does it need to go back to the dealer, and what's the cost?
So what we've done, kind of just because of an education, I guess, and the American customers, we're trying to make this as easy as possible. So we've got a two-year plan where basically you bring the car back, we're going to change your oil for you, we're going to top off your DEF fluid. You'll get 10, 13,000 miles without ever having to top it off. We've inserted the fill tank. It's kind of within the rear compartment. It's fairly simple to fill if you have to fill it, but like I said, to try and help ease the customers into what a diesel is, we're taking care of it for them, zero cost.
For the first 2 years?
For the first 2 years.
Then what? It's like $10 a bottle or $20 a bottle?
Yeah, I mean, GM has their version. There's plenty of them at any gas station that you can find. It's a relatively insignificant cost. I don't remember what the last one was that I bought at the gas store, but...
But it's pretty much sold like washer fluid,
that's
right?
I mean, basically, exactly what it looks like.
Yeah,
it's a little gallon square jug with a nozzle that pops out. You put it in, you pull the trigger, and it fills up and you're good to go for another 10,000. We have a 17-liter tank back there, so it's pretty significant. It has to be the DEF fluid. It can't be some mixture that people have potentially tried or something like that.
Yeah. Some people have the wrong ideas. Urea really is. Yeah.
So we have that, and not to mention, right? We have the 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty on this thing, which relative to the competitors, I mean, anyone that puts those two things on the paper, like I said, we're confident on this product. We've got a lot of time baked into this program.
Good, Ben. Let's bring in another phone call.
Hey guys, it's Jonathan Apple. Ben, just want to say great show. My question is for Josh. Josh, do you believe General Motors gets the credit it deserves for being a leading manufacturer in technology, whether it be the Cruise diesel or the Chevy Volt? If you think it does, tell me how. If you think it doesn't get credit for being leading the industry by the media, tell me why you think it doesn't. Anyway, listen, love the products. Want to hear about some other small car performance products. I know you probably can't tell us, but love to see the 130 run out. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Yeah, the 130 concept car. That got a lot of attention.
Do we get the credit? I know all of our greatnesses. I know our sins as well. And obviously I'm a biased person, I guess I would say. So I don't know if it's really just for me to answer some of those questions. I think in some cases we're judged harder. Some people may say we've earned that. We need to work our way out, and I'm fine if someone wants to say that, because I think we are. I think if you look at our product and where we've been, where we're heading, it's really exciting. As a car guy, I can tell you I'm very excited with where I see our future going. I've never been in a position within this company where I've had such faith within the executive leadership, and it's not what they say, it's what they're actually doing. It's their actions that are showing that they care about the product, that they know what it takes to make the customer happy, that they're not going to sacrifice anything on the product side of it. And myself, coming from the performance side, you know, if we want to talk about cutting cost or cutting this, the first thing to go is, oh, well, let's pull that out. And that is completely off the table with our senior leadership right now. So it's the coolest environment I've worked in, bar none, including my race car experience.
Well, that's saying something then. Hey, George from Brooklyn wants to know, when you're at a gas station, do people notice that you've got a diesel car?
No, when we were developing this, though, our engine chief engineer was pulled into a gas tank and started filling his cruise up at a diesel pump, and someone came running out of the store to start yelling at him, "Hey, that's diesel!" But I've never been questioned in driving these cars. I probably have more hours than anyone in them, but no one's ever stopped me and said, "Hey, is that a direct injection or diesel or whatever car?"
I've had a similar experience at gas stations where, they turn on the pump from inside and they wouldn't turn it on because I had a car, and they kept saying over the intercom, "Don't you realize that's a diesel pump?" And I'm like trying to, I had to go inside and tell them, yes, because that's a diesel car. They were like, "Really? I didn't know they put diesels in cars."
Well, there is that difference in the nozzle size, so you can't.
That's right.
Right.
Ben, we got another phoner. Let's bring it in.
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood calling Cleveland, Ohio. Got a two question. First question, what happened to the Mazda diesels at Daytona in the GX class? All the engines blew up. Anybody know what happened? It affected all of them. And my second question is to Mr. Tavel. Back before this economy tanked, GM was a they were showing a 4.5-liter late-duty Duramax V8 diesel. Is that dead, or is it still on a table someplace? It might get put someplace. Thank you very much. Good show. Later. Bye.
Peter, why don't you take the racing one first?
I never heard the exact reason, but they blew up real good, both of them. So they've got some work to do. And that 4.5-liter diesel was, as you recall, the engine of the year. In some won some award and they shelved it during the bankruptcy. I asked Mark Royce about it, and he didn't say.
I think I'll follow my senior leader.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Guidance on that one.
Mark didn't say anything about it. Josh is not going to start pulling
forward. Do you remember reading about it? It was a spectacular engine and got all this praise. And
it didn't take from, it was reversed.
Yeah, technical awards and everything. And I've been waiting for GM to, I thought that was going to show up as an option in the Corvette.
Wow.
You know, just saying.
Very interesting. My guess is it's a fully developed diesel. GM's got it in its back pocket, and if somewhere down the road, cafe-wise, they need it, my guess is they could pull it out of their back pocket, is my guess. But we have a guest on the show who's not talking because his boss isn't either. I'm just teasing you, Jeff.
On the diesel question, I poked around with a lot of my friends over at Daytona, and I've got a little bit more feedback, but I'll keep my mouth shut on that one.
Well, you know, my point is it blowed up real good, all three of them, and it did it in front of everybody. But you know what? That's why you go racing.
Yeah.
Mazda's doing it to improve the breed, and my hat's off to them. You can bet they are burning the midnight oil, figuring out what they're going to be doing for the next race.
Yeah, that's part of racing. You blow up and figure it out and go back.
And they are putting a diesel in the new Mazda 6, so later this year.
That is the diesel.
Yeah. They'll have the diesel there, and it's being sold in Japan right now.
Mm-hmm.
And their demand for that engine was 500% above their plan in Japan.
Well, they were also touting the stock bottom end. I'm not so sure that's a good thing on a race engine.
That's probably what let go. But, I mean, they're making a big deal. I want to say, if I remember right, 80% of the parts in the race engine are...
Maybe the next iteration of the race engine will be about 40% stock.
Milled from a billet. Ben, do we have another phoner there?
Yes, this is Steve Eisenberg. You know, these turbos and all of this discussion around there, and the thing that I think is being missed here is the fact that forced induction is the replacement for displacement. And if you're going to use the turbos or the superchargers and force more air into the combustion chamber, you're going to need more fuel because it'll just lean out. So I agree that the forced induction, when you have the mini, the four cylinders, you can get your better mileage. But if you're going to want to get the need the performance of those add-ons, you're going to get the same fuel economy as a V8. Thank you.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, active fuel management tries to do the same thing, but you still got to spend some parts. So yeah, it's the same concept. It's right on spot.
We got a whole bunch more questions. We're just not going to have the time to get to them. But CD Nay says, will the diesel cruise be sold in Canada?
Yes.
Yes. Oh. And he says, diesel is 10 cents per liter. Well, it doesn't say whether it's more or less than regular. I guess diesel fuel is better priced in Canada than the U.S.?
Well, I mean, in general, diesel's a little more expensive. You know, at times when we were developing this, it was dead even or a little bit better. At times, it's 50 cents more or so. You know, will that change in the future? I there's no way I'm ever going to try and predict that. But to me, would it be a factor? My wife drives an Eco Manual. If we were buying another car right now, just from the penny-pinching side, so I can put my more money to the race car, I think we would do the diesel. So that would be where my head is.
Yeah. Well, look, we ought to wrap it up here. But, Josh, thanks so much for coming on. Yeah. Great having you, man.
I appreciate
terrific
it.
Having you.
Enjoy it and enjoy the show.
Yeah. And next time we'll have you back. You got to bring a car.
A car sitting. Actually, we'll be driving a car. That's what we'll
do. Actually, cool. Next time we'll have him bring his pal Mark Rice with him, and we'll talk with Mark
about the need for a diesel in the Corvette.
Well, no, I don't. Gary, thanks for coming again. Oh, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. John?
Peter, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you next week, John.
Thanks, everybody, for having tuned in tonight.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern,
Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.